I'm honored to introduce Justice Sasso as our moderator today on the Students for Fair Admissions case. The recent United States Supreme Court opinion that upended affirmative action, Justice Sasso is the 93rd Supreme Court Justice and the 7th woman ever to serve on the Florida Supreme Court. She is a diligent originalist, devoted mother, and diehard Gator fan. She has had a distinguished and varied career. She served as a chief judge on the 6th DCA, and before then as a judge on the 5th DCA. Immediately after law school, she also was in private practice, served as a guardian ad litem representing abused and neglected children, and afterwards served as chief deputy general counsel to Governor Scott in Tallahassee. Many of you went to Justice Sasso's in a recent investiture, where she spoke about many things, but in particular her grandfather, and how he fled from Cuba in the 1950s, and how this impacted Justice Sasso's worldview and shaped her worldview. So we are honored to have you today. We're excited for our panel to talk about Students for Fair Admissions. Thank you, and please welcome me in introducing Justice Sasso and our panel.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and thank you all for being here. We're here because on June 29th, 2023, the Supreme Court of the United States decided Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard, a consolidated case in which the court considered the race-based admission practices of Harvard College and the University of North Carolina. In a 6-3 majority opinion, the court held the consideration of race and admissions to colleges and universities unconstitutional, declaring illegal a practice institutions of higher education have used for almost 50 years. Applying the same strict scrutiny framework it did in Grutter 20 years earlier, the court concluded that Harvard and UNC could demonstrate neither sufficiently coherent compelling interest nor the exacting connection required between racial classifications and their purported ends. Thus, the court held that eliminating racial discrimination as prohibited by the 14th Amendment means eliminating all of it, even those forms of discrimination that are ostensibly designed to help racial minorities. In doing so, the Supreme Court arguably vindicated Justice Harlan's great dissent in Plessy v. Ferguson when he said, "In the view of the Constitution and the eye of the law, there is in this country no superior, dominant, ruling class of citizens. There is no caste here. Our Constitution is colorblind and neither knows nor tolerates classes among citizens." The principal dissenting opinion disagreed, espousing what Justice Thomas referred to as the anti-subordination theory, specifically that the Equal Protection Clause is expressly race-conscious and permits race-conscious efforts to affect equality. There's two aspects of the majority's opinion that are of particular note to our discussion today. First, the court expressly excluded military academies from its holding, citing the potentially distinct interests they may present. And second, the court noted that its decision did not preclude universities from considering an applicant's discussion of how race impacted his or her life, so long as such consideration is restricted to the applicant's experience as an individual. In a concurrence, Justice Gorsuch, joined by Justice Thomas, explained that there could be independent bases to strike down the institution's admissions practice and urged the court to disaggregate equal protection analysis from statutory analysis. He also recognized the applicability of the decision to the employment context. And so to help us understand how those aspects of the case, and the case in general, is going to affect academia going forward, we have our distinguished panel, who I will introduce now. Professor Macklin has several distinguished titles, but he assured me I could introduce him as just Professor Macklin, a professor of constitutional studies now at the University of Florida. Go Gators. But he's also taught at Boston University School of Law, Cornell, Harvard Law School, and the University of Kentucky College of Law. He has written several amicus briefs. I've been informed also in Florida for the ACLU. He has been cited in several law review articles. And he is currently teaching, in addition to constitutional law, criminal procedure. All right, well, thank you so much for being here. We also have with us Mr. Norris. He probably most notably to this discussion argued the Harvard case in the United States Supreme Court. He also argued the CIC services versus IRS case in the United States Supreme Court. Before that, was a law clerk to Justice Clarence Thomas of the United States Supreme Court, Judge William Pryor of the U.S. Court for Appeals for the 11th Circuit, and for Judge Karen LaCraft of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. He obtained degrees from Vanderbilt University in undergraduate and law school degrees, and he lives in Knoxville, right?
All right. Balls.
We'll just let that one slip. Thank you for being here. And I should clarify, there's full bios for all of our panelists in the program. We also have with us Mr. Westhill, who is the president and general counsel for the Center for Equal Opportunity. As an attorney, he focuses on matter of constitutional and civil rights and researches and speaks about civil rights, civil liberties, and related issues such as race relations, social change, and equal opportunity. His writing has been published in Newsweek, National Review, and the Wall Street Journal. He's appeared on Fox News, Newsmax, and C-SPAN. And he is also a Gator, go Gators, with undergraduate degree from University of Florida Law School, sorry, JD from University of Florida, okay. Undergrad from UNC at Chapel Hill, and he has served in the Navy. So with that, I will turn it over to you, Mr. Norris.
Thank you, Justice Sasso. Thank you, everyone. It's great to be here. It is about 40 degrees colder in Tennessee, so it is really great to be here. I just want to give an overview of the Harvard case and give you a little bit of kind of the behind the scenes on what happened there. The last panel was about young attorneys. I was 34 when I argued the Harvard case at the Supreme Court. That's fairly young for an attorney. Could use some advice on how to process the emotions of already having argued the biggest case of my career so early. But I'm getting through that. The reason I got to argue, though, unfortunately, is Will Consovoy, the named partner in my law firm, got sick with brain cancer. He's no longer with us. He is the mastermind of these cases, was the greatest legal mind, I'm convinced, in America, and we still miss him. But the Harvard case is really two cases, as Justice Sasso said. It's a case against Harvard, which is our oldest private university, and UNC Chapel Hill, which is arguably our oldest public university. They say so. I think UVA has an argument with them about that. But both cases came up together. It's a small miracle that they came up together. We filed them on the same day, but they really got off on two different tracks, just kind of the nature of federal civil litigation. But it turns out Harvard was discovery happened, we went to trial, we had an appeal, that decision was ready to go, and we had not even finished the trial yet in UNC by the time the Harvard was teed up for the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court did what's called a CVSG in Harvard, where they call for the views of the Solicitor General, which kicked us basically a year, which allowed the UNC trial to finish, which allowed us to file what's called another sort of Supreme Court oddity called cert before judgment in UNC, where you skip the appellate court and go up to the Supreme Court. It actually happened in Grutter and Gratz, the two most famous affirmative action cases before these. So we had a precedent for that. But we skipped, and the cases got up together back at the Supreme Court. So why Harvard? Harvard is the key university in the affirmative action cases. So Justice Powell's famous opinion in Bakke cites Harvard, even though it was not a party to the case, cites an amicus brief that Harvard wrote about how it used race and said that Harvard is really the model for how we ought to be doing this. You shouldn't have quotas and set-asides. You should consider race as one small factor in individualized decision-making in a holistic manner. That's what Harvard said it was doing in the 70s in Bakke. Grutter, which really adopts Justice Powell's opinion in Bakke, again cites Harvard as the model. Harvard is cited again in the Fisher cases. So Harvard is held up as the way you're supposed to do affirmative action legally. Unfortunately, Harvard had never been a party to any of these cases, and no one had ever really figured out how it used race. So our lawsuit was the first time that anyone got discovery into Harvard's admissions process. And I'll just give you a little bit about what we found. The racial preferences that Harvard were giving were not individualized one small factor. They were gigantic. 45% of admitted African Americans and Hispanics would not have gotten into Harvard but for race under the system that we challenged. Being African American or Hispanic was worth in the admissions process about the same as a high schooler doing original scientific research. That's how big of a boost it was. The law had long said that universities who use race have to constantly assess whether they're satisfying strict scrutiny, which means figure out whether race-neutral alternatives would work about as well. Harvard had never once looked at race-neutral alternatives, and said until 3 years after we sued it, then it convened a committee to study race-neutral alternatives, staffed the committee initially with professors and academics, killed that committee, restaffed it with their litigation attorneys on the case that we were litigating. And finally, Harvard had long been investigated in the 80s by the Department of Justice for discrimination against Asian Americans. That had long been sort of something that was over their admissions process. Turns out, years later, they were found free and clear by DOJ, but years later, there were some articles written about Harvard and how the number of Asian Americans who were applying had gone way up, but it looked as if the number that were being admitted had been pretty steady over the years. We found out in discovery that that article triggered an internal study at Harvard about whether that was true. And the internal study found that Asian Americans were not getting in as much as you would think that they would into Harvard. And the reason was something called the personal rating. Harvard does a personal rating of every application and kind of tries to gauge what they call whether you're kind or considerate or effervescent, or it's a very subjective rating. And Harvard's own internal study found that Asian Americans were getting pummeled on this rating. And that was the reason why you saw the mismatch in what you would expect their admissions numbers to be and what they really were. That is what civil rights litigators call a smoking gun. And we found it in discovery. And the kicker was, we also found an email that said, "We really ought not share this outside of Harvard." So both sides put up their own experts in the litigation, ran the numbers again. Our expert and their expert found that if you take the personal rating out, the part where we say the discrimination was happening, really the anti-Asian stereotyping was happening, if you take that out, both sides agreed that there is a statistically significant penalty against Asian Americans in Harvard's admissions process. So that was what we found. Fast forward to the argument, which was held on Halloween of 2022. There was some press leading into the case that said, this is two cases involving two Supreme Court veterans, which was hilarious. I had argued one case before. it was during COVID. It was on the phone in my office. It was a little different. So it was my second argument. My opponent, it was his 82nd argument. He was a former Solicitor General. So it was a strange framing for the case. But the argument was also very, very long. It went about 5 hours, which is long. The first argument, I was second, the first argument was UNC. It went about 3 hours, which normally is it could be an annoyance if you're arguing second, but I had to listen very closely to that first argument because it was the same exact case. So I was very sleepy when I stood up at hour three. I had taken this is more information than you'd like. I'd taken a 5 hour energy before the argument.
Perfect.
And then before my argument, I took a second 5 hour energy. So if I sound a little weird, I had 10 hours of energy going through my veins when I was arguing that case. So we got the decision in June. I was actually there in person when they read it down. I highly recommend you go back and listen to the opinion announcement, which is now available online. Listen to Justice Thomas's reading of his concurrence. I think it is one of the most important pieces of American oratory in our history. It's so impactful. But what the court said is, I think, some pretty broad holdings against racial preferences. It said that using race as a plus means you're using it as a minus in a zero-sum admissions process, which is illegal. It said if you give somebody a preference based on their race alone, so you don't, nothing individualized about them, but just because they checked the certain box for race, that is stereotyping and is illegal and in itself violates strict scrutiny. And the court said, really for the first time, that the categories that everyone uses to classify us by race, which really come from the federal government, are arbitrary and incoherent and were never designed to be a metric for any sort of program. So that's the sort of the key holdings that I see from the decision. I think there's two takeaways for me. One is that it's hard to read the decision as just about Harvard and UNC, because every private and public university in America who was using race has now at least said that they're stopping after the decision. So it can't just be about those two schools. And then I think we're going to talk today about the sort of broader implications beyond college admissions. My view, and I'll say this again in the discussion, there's a lot of things that were going on with racial preferences outside of academics that were illegal before the Harvard decision, in my view. But I do think that a lot of those programs were justified on the basis of Grutter and Gratz, on the basis of diversity. It's called DEI for a reason. The D is diversity. That's a buzzword that comes from Grutter, and I think that was seen by many as justifying these types of programs. And now I think from their perspective, perhaps Harvard really is informative about the future of those programs.
All right. Thank you. Professor Macklin.
Thank you very much. And I just arrived in Florida about a year and a half ago, and I have often gotten the question, why am I here? And in fact, it came up expressly and directly when we were interviewing, we being the University of Florida, 11 College of Law, we were interviewing a candidate last year, and some of the people who had been recently hired, they brought us in the room so we can supposedly recruit this candidate, and he went around and he asked one of my colleagues why they're there, and he said, well, you know, it's because of the students and the programs and the professors. And then the second person who was asked the question, she said basically the same thing, and then the candidate looked at me and said, well, why are you here? I looked at him, I said, well, I just spent the last 35 years in Boston watching Tom Brady win 6 Super Bowls, and he moved down to Tampa, and I figured I'd be a lot closer to him if I took this offer from the University of Florida, so that's kind of why I'm here. And I don't know if he appreciated the humor involved, but I'm glad I'm here today. And I want to push back a little bit on what Mr. Norris has just said, and I only have 7 minutes, and a good professor takes him 7 minutes to get get his name and credentials out. So I'm gonna have to be focused. But I want to raise the question, and Mr. Norris referred to it: was Grutter overruled in Students for Fair Admission? And you could tack on to that whether Fisher II was overruled, and I'm going to assume, like I often do sometimes in my class, that my students have actually read the assignment. So I'm going to assume people know what Grutter is, and assume also they know what Fisher II is, because I know the panelists all know what those cases are. With respect to Grutter, there is no explicit statement in Chief Justice Roberts' opinion that he has overruled Grutter. And when the Supreme Court overrules major cases, because I take it we would argue Grutter's a major case, when they overrule major cases, they let you know it. They let you know it explicitly. There's no, and I went back and I reread the Chief Justice's opinion yesterday, because I had read about a week ago, and I said, well, you know, if I'm going to go down to the Federalist Society and say all this stuff, I better make sure I know what I'm talking about. There's no explicit statement in Roberts' opinion that he is, or that the majority is overruling Grutter, nor is there any implicit statement that he's overruling Grutter. And in fact, I found at least three passages in Roberts' opinion indicating that he is not announcing a broad, across-the-board holding that race can never be used in college admissions. In fact, these passages indicate that the court is only invalidating Harvard and UNC's admissions program and not overruling Grutter. Well, what are those passages? Well, let me quickly go to the first one, and this is on the page 22 of the slip opinion, where Roberts says, and I hope you don't mind if I quote him, but we have permitted race-based admissions only within the confines of narrow restrictions. University programs must comply with strict scrutiny. They may never use race as a stereotype or negative, and at some point they must end. Respondents' admission systems, all right, however well-intentioned and implemented in good faith, fail each of these criteria. And then in a paragraph later, he says, respondents have fallen short of satisfying that burden. That is not a statement that race can never be used by colleges by college and university admissions. And then on page 26 of the slip opinion, Robert states, and I quote, courts may not license separating students on the basis of race without an exceedingly persuasive justification that is measurable and concrete enough to permit judicial review. The programs at issue here do not satisfy that standard. Any sophisticated lawyer knows that is not an across-the-board statement. That is a statement saying the programs here do not satisfy those standards. And then finally, on page 39, and by the way, I was discussing with Justice Sasso, Roberts' opinion is 40 pages long. Your former boss's opinion, I believe, is 60 or so pages long. And then Sotomayor's opinion is about 80 pages. There ought to be a rule that the concurring opinions and dissents can't be longer than the majority opinion. Just they need a rule like that.
Got some agreement.
No, I'm sorry. Page 39, the last passage. All right. For the reasons provided, the Harvard and UNC admissions programs cannot be reconciled with the guarantees of the Equal Protection Clause. Both programs lack sufficiently focused and measurable objectives warranting the use of race, unavoidably employ race in a negative manner, involve racial stereotyping, and lack meaningful endpoints. We have never permitted admission programs to work in that way, and we will not do so today. Now, the same analysis applies to Fisher, and Fisher 2, all right, he doesn't say it's been overruled either. In fact, he positively describes Fisher, and again, don't take my word for it. Let's see what he says on page 37 of the slip opinion. The principal dissent's reliance on Fisher 2 is similarly mistaken. There, by a 4-3 vote, the court upheld a sui generis. Now, I was forced to take Latin in the private school that my mom sent me to. We used to wear ties and jackets, and they made us take 3 years of Latin. I hated it. I absolutely hated it. And I thought, what's the point? Well, I got to law school and I found out the point of taking 3 years of Latin. There, by a 4-3 vote, the court upheld a sui generis race-based admissions program used by the University of Texas, whose goal it was to enroll a critical mass of certain racial minorities. Again, Fisher has not been overruled. And I'm getting close to my 7 minutes and I'll stop it here. Finally, toward the end of his opinion, the Chief Justice criticizes the dissenters for ignoring the principle that the Constitution is colorblind, which he claims was the foundation of cases like Loving versus Virginia, Yick Wo, and Shelley v. Kramer, and Bowling versus Sharp. And then he says, the dissents, and I'm quoting now, Roberts, surely cannot claim the mantle of stare decisis while pursuing it. Roberts wouldn't have used that language, and particularly the reference to stare decisis, if he were overruling Grutter and Fisher too. Okay, I'm going to stop there because my time is up. I have a couple of other points. Maybe it'll come up in the Q&A. Thank you.
Right. Well, thank you so much. We'll look forward to the extra. Yeah, go for it.
Okay, hello? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. So first I want to thank the organizers, the Federalist Society, and my many Florida friends in the audience for being here. Thank you so much. I'm beyond grateful for the opportunity to speak here today. I usually speak off the cuff, but I've got some thoughts I want to actually be clear on, so I have my prepared remarks I'll read from here. We celebrate 10 years since this conference first launched, and it reminds me of the little nudge that helped give rise to that Judge Katsas mentioned last night at the banquet, the Federal Society Student Symposium we held at the University of Florida in 2014, for which I served as chair. Many of you were there, and I remember discussing, we should have a similar conference for lawyers. To know where we started, to watch our progression over the course of the last decade, and to see where we are today, I can't help but think of Justice Scalia's quote regarding the growth of the Federalist Society itself. He said, "We thought we were just planting a wildflower among the weeds of academic liberalism, and it turned out to be an oak." Congratulations to everyone for helping grow this oak of a conference. It's fantastic. And I must devote the most special of thank yous to my loving and devoted wife, Michelle, who's here today. Thank you very much. She was at that little seat of a symposium 10 years ago. She stood beside me and supported all of my crazy ambitions all these years. With her is our 7-year-old daughter, Madeline, and our 5-year-old son, Benjamin. Thank you very much. It's their first time attending any of my speaking engagements, and they're sitting still, they're being quiet, and they're behaving. All right? Okay. My family is a big part of my motivation, of course, including in my work on equal protection issues. Our family is a small representation of the American melting pot. I'm a biracial man, black and white. Michelle is a biracial woman, white and Vietnamese. I grew up poor, she middle class. Our kids represent a combination of all these things. What we want for them, more than anything, is an equal shot at pursuing their happiness, neither preference nor downgrade on the basis of something like their ancestry, just simply to be judged on the content of their character and potential to succeed or fail on merit. That's what we want for everyone. Which brings me to the topic of this panel. Except I'm not in my initial remarks going to address the affirmative action cases directly, sorry to disappoint. But I only get about 8 minutes. I've burned about 2 of them already. I just addressed these cases at the Federal Society's National Lawyers Convention in November. There's video online of that. I've also written quite a bit about this. Some of it's in the CLE materials you haven't looked at yet. We'll have time to discuss on the panel the cases directly, and I want to address something different but inextricably intertwined with recent developments in equal protection law. That is, once again, trying to grapple with answering what W.E.B. Du Bois called the old question. The question posed to and answered by my hero Frederick Douglass in his time, and that is, what shall be done with the Negro? But perhaps a little updating for 2024. Let's ask, what shall be done with black people? I ask because racial affirmative action in college admissions was an effort to do something with black people. It was intended virtuously to address the disproportionately low number of black students at colleges and elsewhere in high society. The effort was to make up for having actively prevented black applicants from being admitted, no matter the strength of their academic credentials. But over time, as black applicants were not only welcomed but widely preferred, affirmative action's principal effort morphed into propping up black applicants, who were on the whole, and the data are clear on this point, have been less academically competitive as compared to applicants of other races, such as whites and Asians. So what now? Now that this thing that has been doing with black people is prohibited, what shall be done with black people? I mentioned that my hero Frederick Douglass proffered an answer over a century and a half ago in 1865, immediately following emancipation, at a time when black people were facing unimaginable difficulties. He answered simply, do nothing with us. Give us a chance to stand on our own legs. I don't think that long ago sage advice has been consistently followed over time by the left or the right. Surprise. In my view, as a result of doing with black people, a favorite center-left activity, we saw the phenomenal successes of black people in the early to mid-20th century, despite extreme racial bigotry, including the formation of a black middle class at an astonishing rate, development of black millionaires, thousands of black people serving in public office, a black marriage rate roughly the same as the white marriage rate, 64% to 67% respectively, turn into the languishing socioeconomic disparities that we hear so frequently about and pleased to do something with or for minorities, or in pointing the finger at racism of one kind or other. We read, for example, pages and pages of these statistics and protestations in the SFFA dissenting opinions. But let's be real. Affirmative action was never going to be the answer to pluck me or any of the other hordes of poor minority kids up from our circumstances to change those statistics. Indeed, affirmative action at elite institutions as practice has been long criticized, I think justly, for mainly helping well-to-do and kids of highly educated black Americans and African and Caribbean immigrants. On the other hand, as a result of failing to properly develop the conditions upon which a formerly enslaved and long-time discriminated against, demeaned, and dehumanized people can thrive, we all, including the center right, have failed to give black people the fullest chance to stand on our own legs. Now, before tossing the tomatoes, let me remind you, I am currently, and have been since day 1 of law school, without lapse, a card-carrying member of the Federalist Society, and it's because of top-flight lawyers like Cam and all of you that we got SFFA and have a more equal legal playing field today upon which everyone can better stand on their own legs. Hallelujah. However, the law is but a mere blunt tool. It is necessary but insufficient. We must persuade hearts and minds. We have been inadequate at this task. And so affirmative action supporters and opponents alike are criticized for their shortcomings in closing achievement gaps that fall along racial lines. Thus, SFFA does more to provide an opening to reevaluate the old question, what shall be done with black people, than it does to close it. My message to the left is simply stop doing with us. As Douglass lamented, your doing with us has already played the mischief with us. From affirmative action to modern DEI, much of your doing has backfired or caused new problems because, in part, by its nature, the efforts amount to what Booker T. Washington called artificial forcing. It is hubris to suppose that force will solve rather than exacerbate the longest standing problem in American history, race relations. It will only and has only led to counterforce, simply more force in a different direction. My message to everyone, including the right, give black people our fullest chance to stand on our own legs. Recognize race disparities in America as a national crisis, a national embarrassment, and not simply dismiss it as a black problem or black issue. A similar sentiment I've heard with other issues, such as so-called women's issues or gay issues, they are all American issues. And I'm not accusing any one person or group. I'm just pointing out that what I've experienced. This is a warning. We cannot be surprised when the good people of America, who are perceptive especially to injustice and seek to correct it, but who do not make it their life's business to study this kind of thing deeply, but rather turn for guidance to those who do, are more swayed by people advancing foolish ideas in a serious way rather than we, who have sometimes been guilty of advancing serious ideas in foolish ways. In that way, we've been half responsible for foolhardy efforts like race preferential affirmative action and DEI. We must persuade our fellow Americans who don't understand the dangers of race preferences and DEI. And doing so means adopting messages and launching initiatives that will address concerns that America be a just and fair nation that provides opportunities for all. A campaign to ban programs, initiatives, and concepts that counterforce without making a good case as to why they are bad for everyone is not the most effective method to change hearts and minds and thereby to achieve long-term success in this space. So I say, destroy your enemies by making them your friends. Oh, okay. Oh, thanks. Do I not do that when I make them my friends? While remaining true to principle, of course, work together towards shared goals and experiment with those methods likely to lift all boats, like advocating the right to earn an honest living, recognizing threats to property rights and the vital right of parents to choose the best school for their children. Those measures alone would do more to improve access to opportunity and upward mobility for the disadvantaged than race preferences and college admissions did for half a century. Of equal or greater importance outside the law is a profound cultural work that needs to be undertaken in earnest within our communities, placing renewed and greater emphasis on generating and implementing ideas that support the formation and maintenance of healthy families and communities. Prioritize world-class education and training, K-12, college, apprenticeships, whatever, and holding up meaningful work as desirable, be it military, blue-collar, white-collar, whatever. Donate to those individuals and organizations that are doing these things, churches, civic organizations, and yes, nonprofits like mine. We'll be sending around the collection plate shortly. These groups and people can be agents for doing the important work you want to see done and we need done. Ultimately, what I'm saying is that much of what we're doing today isn't really about us. It's about my kids. It's about your kids. It's about what comes next for future generations. We should not let this critical post-SFFA moment slip away by either resting on our laurels or by overreaching. We should instead capture this moment by marshaling serious ideas in serious ways, perhaps finally recognizing that the old question is really what should be done with America. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. I think you can all already tell how fortunate we are that our panelists have decided to join us this morning. All thought-provoking comments, and I'd love to get you all's thoughts first, but I thought we could start, maybe this is just the judge in me, but by defining some terms. We talk a lot about, we hear the term race-based admissions, we hear the term race-conscious admissions. I don't know if you want to take a stab at explaining what DEI means. But I think it would be helpful as we start this discussion to understand how each of you view the nomenclature and what you'll be referring to as you go through your remarks. Would you like to start? Do you think there's a difference between race-based and race-conscious?
For constitutional law purposes, no. Okay. The Equal Protection Clause, the way I have understood it, and most importantly, the way I view what the Supreme Court has done, I guess starting with Strouder versus West Virginia, is that the use of race is will trigger constitutional scrutiny. And so when you say race conscience versus race base, if it's a governmental official doing either one of those two things, that triggers the Equal Protection Clause.
Okay. Anything to add?
I'll just say we now have a final judgment against Harvard, and that final judgment says something like, Harvard shall not consider the fact of an applicant's race when making admissions decisions. And it goes on to say, Harvard's admissions officers won't be able to see anymore the checkbox, the racial data that people fill out on the application. So I kind of think that's what we were talking about, is the using race itself as a plus or a minus in the admissions process.
Well, I agree with that, but I think the, because I'm not the litigator here, I think the decision in the cases is broader than that. I think it has to be, it's not just at the decision point and making a determination among a number of applicants whether or not race can be sort of a factor in what they use. What Chief Justice wrote in the majority opinion was that they hadn't blessed this type of admissions program, quote, admissions program, that was using race to discriminate against applicants. Admissions program has to be broader than the decision point. And I think that intent really matters here. If the intent is to distinguish between various applicants, even in recruiting, you know, there's some suggestion, even by the Biden administration, that targeted recruiting efforts might be okay after SFFA. I think that's wrong, actually. And I think we ought to have more cases, maybe brought by folks in the audience. Cam's pretty busy already with some of the easier sort of low-hanging fruit after this thing with the law firm fellowships and so forth. But it has to, admissions program has to be more than just a decision point. And so I think intent really matters here, and will matter going forward.
Can I step in?
Go for it.
Well, then how do you explain page 39? I'm sorry, I've got the slip opinion here. How do you explain page 39 where Robert says, at the same time as all parties agree, nothing in this opinion should be construed as prohibiting universities from considering an applicant's discussion of race, from considering an applicant's discussion of how race affected his or her life, be it through discrimination, inspiration, or otherwise.
Yeah, and I think that's the question moving forward, especially when we see universities moving to, you know, the personal essay format, video essay format we've seen at some schools. What is the impact of that statement going forward?
Well, I think it might have been directed. The question might have been directed to me. I mean, the
oh, it was.
Okay. Well, I'll say first of all, I think that passage, and I've said this in a number of different forums, was an unforced error. Actually, if you're trying to eliminate race discrimination, and eliminating it means eliminating all of it, why even put that there? Right? It's never been illegal to allow applicants to write about their race and how it might have affected some issue in their life, how they overcame even racial discrimination, or how, for example, in the Biden administration's guidance on what is potentially permissible after SFFA, how learning to cook Hmong, you know, traditional Hmong food really shaped your views of the world in some way or other. It's never been illegal for applicants to do that. The question, you know, and quite frankly, what the majority is saying here is that there may be something more to the writing about those sorts of issues that would be perfectly fine for admissions officials to consider when thinking about who they want to admit, right? Did you overcome something? Does that say something about your ability to overcome adversity? Does it show something about your grit, stick-to-itiveness? These sorts of other important qualities, not your race qua race. That is what cannot be considered. That's pretty clear, I think, in the decision.
Well, again, as Randall Kennedy has said, whenever you allow the government, especially the government, to consider race, even it for a little bit, that's problematic. And I would expect many people in this room to take the same view. But, the language is there, and to say, well, that was a mistake, but the rest of the opinion is not a mistake. No, Roberts is too careful and too good a lawyer, too careful a judge and too good a lawyer to make mistakes, particularly in the last section of his opinion. So I would not advise looking at that. We can disagree with it, just like we can disagree with the rest of the parts of the opinion. But to describe that as a mistake, I wouldn't advise that sort of approach in studying this case.
Well, Professor, I'd be interested to hear your take. You highlighted in your initial comments the strict scrutiny analysis, essentially, that in this specific opinion, there was particular attention made to the fact that Harvard's not able to demonstrate a compelling interest. Their goals of having a diverse classroom was not measurable. Do you think there is a way? Do you think that's kind of left open to future cases, that an institution might be able to establish a compelling interest?
I think it would be extremely difficult, and Mr. Norris brought up the fact that every school asked, and I'm not familiar with it, but I take his word on this, that schools who had been using race have stopped using race, and I think he was making that point to say that this is a broad opinion, but I would be kind of interested in your view of whether you think Grutter's been overruled in light of the fact there's no explicit statement. But to answer your question, Justice, I think it'd be really hard, but my point to this audience was that they didn't do it here. They didn't do it here and say Grutter has been overruled. Now, Mr. Norris's former boss, he went so far as to say, or all he could say, well, for all intents and purposes. Again, justices on the court, they don't speak that way when they're talking about overruling a major case. They say, this case is overruled, not for all intents and purposes. So I think it would be very difficult for a school to get over that strict scrutiny. Strict scrutiny is meant to be strict in fact. It's meant to be a difficult case, and Roberts rightly pointed out that one of the very few times in which the government satisfied the strict scrutiny standard when they used race was Korematsu. And that was wrongly decided, at least as far as the modern court is concerned. But again, it's, I don't think they, I don't read this opinion as overruling Grutter. I don't read it as overruling Fisher II. So some schools, if they want to, with the advice of their lawyers, right, continue to use race, they have to do it very carefully. And one thing that I picked up on Mr. Norris's comment, he described what Harvard and UNC were doing as gigantic in their use of the race. If schools certainly can stay away from what Harvard and UNC have done, it might very well pass constitutional muster. But again, there's no statement in here where they say they've overruled it or race can never be considered. They certainly knew how to make such a statement if they wanted that to be the message. Okay. Does that answer your question?
It does. Does anybody have a response?
Yeah, two points, really. One about the essay paragraph that the professor mentioned. The Chief Justice actually in that paragraph cites to a part of my argument on the essay question. I'm not saying that my argument is now the law of the land, but I...
Yes, you are.
I reserve the right to argue that in court. But what I said in that passage was, if a university had an essay that had some story of a black or Hispanic student who overcame discrimination, and they had the same essay from an Asian student who overcame discrimination, and they gave them equal credit, that would not be illegal. That's the cited... part of my argument. So I think it's interesting that universities sort of howled about having to live under that regime. That is not what they were doing. They were not taking individual stories of overcoming discrimination or racial culture or identity and crediting those. They were crediting race itself, which is why the opinion really mattered. And on the question of overruling, I mean, I also find it curious that word does not appear in the opinion. I'll just offer some theories as to why. One is that, Grutter itself said that we expect this opinion will no longer be necessary or valid in 25 years. The court cut that off at about 20. but perhaps there's some sort of durational thing going on. They didn't need to overrule Grutter because it had its own expiration date on it. Or maybe another theory is that the law in this area has not changed. It's always been strict scrutiny, and strict scrutiny has always had this limitations. It's just that no university was actually living up to strict scrutiny, and the court finally recognized that. Perhaps that they didn't think they needed to overrule the precedent because the precedent was fine. The problem was that universities were not really living up to it, and courts were not really holding them to that burden. And the last thing I'll say is, remember, Harvard was the model. Harvard was supposed to be doing it the best. They were the ones cited in Bakke and Grutter and Fisher. Harvard was supposed to be what everyone else was doing. And if it was this bad at Harvard, that ought to say something about the legality of everyone else's programs.
Now, when you say no university, would you include the University of Michigan Law School in that, when you, that no university had satisfied strict scrutiny?
Yeah, I think that is exactly the question, right? If Michigan Law School was doing what it was doing in Grutter, you know, would it have lost under the reasoning of Harvard? I think the answer is yes, it would have.
Say that again. You're saying that what Michigan Law School was doing in Grutter did not satisfy strict scrutiny, because that's what the exact opposite of what Grutter said, right?
Yes, that's what.
So you're saying they kind of went back and rewrote, but they're retroactively overruling Grutter without saying so.
I'm not sure I'd go that far, but I remember Fisher already overruled Grutter a little bit. Fisher said, no, there's parts of Grutter that say we ought to give deference to universities when we do strict scrutiny, but we didn't mean that. When you do narrow tailoring, it's
right,
real
I'm talking
scrutiny.
About just the use of race at all. I mean, the consideration of race. Fisher doesn't say Grutter was wrong in allowing the University of Michigan Law School to use race in a holistic manner.
Right. Let me
they don't overrule that part of Grutter.
Let me put it this way. So Michigan does not use race and has not for a long time. There was a constitutional amendment that they stopped. But say that amendment was overruled and Michigan Law School reinstituted the program that they had in 2003, and now you have the Harvard decision. Would that program violate strict scrutiny? I think probably yes.
Like a good professor, Professor Macklin's asking a lot of questions here, and I want to ask a question back.
like a good professor, Professor Macklin's main job is to write a lot of stuff. So he puts his name and where he stands on many articles and books. But I'm happy to try.
I don't see the idea that Grutter wasn't specifically overruled as curious as Cam suggested. I find terrible, actually, because it has provided even the slightest little crack in a window for folks who still might like to see race used in the admissions process. Think of ways in which to get around that. Although I do agree with Justice Thomas in his concurrence, somewhere in that 60 plus pages, he says, for all intents and purposes, Grutter is overruled, despite the fact that the majority doesn't say that. I think he says that because the four criteria that the majority indicates Harvard and UNC and basically every other selective colleges that had been using affirmative action, sort of following the Harvard model, would fail on those criteria. I'm curious, Professor Macklin, if I'm a lawyer for any of those schools, I'm saying, no, you're done, okay? Using race is prohibited. I would say because it's good legal advice.
I'm sorry.
If you are a lawyer suggesting that race might still be used because Grutter's not overturned, how do you get around logically the one part of the decision that says race is used in a negative manner, unavoidably in a zero-sum game of admissions?
Listen, you're making great points. But to answer your first question, you don't want to be sued, right? You don't want to be sued, and you don't want the legal fees associated with that. And again, I don't know the context in which these schools were asked that question, but if it were asked by a reporter, what lawyer would advise his or her client to say, oh yeah, the Supreme Court just decided in two high-profile cases that race can't be used, but you go out there and say, oh, I'm still going to use race. That's just, no lawyer would advise his or her client to do that sort of thing. You don't want to be sued. Now, is there language in the opinion, not only in the majority opinion, but obviously in Thomas's opinion and in Gorsuch's opinion about Title VI that suggests race can never be used? Absolutely. Absolutely. But again, as lawyers, We all know the holding and, well, first of all, how the issue is framed, because how the issue is framed will tell you a lot about where they're going. How the issue is framed, and most importantly, the language of the holding. There was no holding in which they say, because again, in high profile cases, they don't say, oh, you know, we forgot to put Rudder's been overruled, or we forgot to put in the Vivinion, and let's go back and when we get back the advance sheets, let's go back and fix that. No. They knew exactly what they were doing. Now, I don't know why they didn't do it either, because again, the tone and language is there, but the point is they didn't do it. And it, yes, that does leave a sliver, call it hope, call it folly, for a school that wants to try and use race. Okay. Try and use race.
And we can have people start lining up for questions if you have any questions for the panel while the audience is doing so. I think I wanted to seize on a distinction that you made, Devin, on we've talked about point of admission, but I'd be interested on you all's thoughts as to beyond the point of admission. So we see measures at institutions designed as retention policies to retain, you know, certain racial demographics of matriculated students. You see DEI-focused offices, there's campus cultural centers, clubs, lots of kind of groups on campus that divide the students into race-based clubs, for lack of a better word. So do you think there's any broader implication left on campus after the point of admission, or is this all kind of confined to that initial question?
Well, I've already said I don't think it's confined to the decision point. You know, I think basically two things from the decision that militate in favor of that. There are others, but two that I'll point out. One is eliminating race discrimination means eliminating all of it. Any place in which you're making distinctions based on the race of students or of applicants, that's illegal. That's illegal on the 14th Amendment. And then I think also the majority opinion, although there's some language I wish might have been included, I like that this was included, and that is that, quote, the core purpose, end quote, of the 14th Amendment was to eliminate racial distinctions, eliminate race discrimination. And I think that's pretty clear and broad language.
Your response?
Can I get a quick, not so much a response, Devin, but a response to your earlier question?
Sure.
It's also significant that not only did they drop the footnote about the military academies, okay, some of you saw in the paper yesterday, they refused to grant the temporary order of the same people who litigated this case, right?
Too soon.
Right? Well, they said, because again, imagine, because think back to what you learned in law school. There was Brown versus Board of Ed, okay? And on the same day that they decided Brown, they decided Bowling versus Sharp, which of course involved the federal government's segregation of school students in the District of Columbia. Bowling versus Sharp was a very short, Brown was a short, Brown was 11 pages long. Bowling versus Sharp was shorter, and the Chief Justice said it would be unthinkable that we could strike down segregation in the states but not with the federal government. Well, it's at least thinkable here. And this goes to Devin's point about, well, maybe they could allow use of race. Because are we really going to say that the Fifth Amendment's Due Process Clause, and the textualists out there will love this, the Fifth Amendment's Due Process Clause, which the court has read, incorporates the Equal Protection Clause. Are we really going to say what we impose or what we require of the states under the Equal Protection Clause, no use of race ever, is okay when it comes to the federal government? I don't think so. They're not going to do that.
All right. We'll move to audience questions now. I would just ask everybody to actually ask a question. I'll start to my right.
Thank you. Good morning, and thank you all for being here. I'm a recently separated naval officer and first-time FedSoc member, so this is all new for me. But my question actually relates to the exception that was carved out for the service academies, and the court is being asked to consider that issue now. My question relates to whether the precedent set in this case and their eventual decision on the service academies is likely to extend to merit-based military selections that do not involve an enlistment contract, something like a special duty officer program or something with a more subjective accession pipeline where there is a board, interviews, interest statements, and if that precedent will extend there.
Yeah, sure. So just full disclosure, thank you for your service. And full disclosure, my law firm has filed those lawsuits against the Naval Academy and West Point, following up on the footnote. And I'll tell you, you know, they admit to using race. I'll tell you, this is my view. You know, this is not objective. My view is that from what we've found out so far, they use race like old school, like Bakke grad style, like points and set asides, not just like Harvard and Michigan Law School. But my understanding is that at least outwardly, the military does not admit to using race when making promotions within the military. They only will admit to doing it at the admissions level at the military academies. And another thing to keep in mind about the future of all this, the government's main argument in Harvard and UNC was the civilian universities need to use race because we get, you know, two-thirds of our officers come from the civilian universities in the ROTC programs. And so if the racial diversity is hampered at the civilian universities, it's going to affect the military, and we have a national security interest in that not happening. That argument also does not appear in the majority opinion. I think the court was not persuaded by it. So that's just an interesting factoid, as well as we did get an order last night in the West Point case where the Supreme Court said they're not going to grant relief now. But those cases are, at least the Naval Academy case is barreling towards a trial this year, and we'll see what happens with West Point.
I wanted to just make a comment as a veteran myself as well, more from a personal standpoint. On the legal side of things, I think the analysis that was conducted in the Harvard and UNC cases applies to, by and large, to the service academies as well. And I think it's important, the points that Cam just raised, of course. But as a lowly enlisted man in the Navy, but who was attached to a Swift Boat Combat Squadron, luckily I never saw combat in one of the lucky ones. But you know, one of the things to keep in mind about the military and the distinct interests associated with the military is that people are risking their lives to go into battle. This isn't the same as feeling more comfortable in the workplace or seeing more people that look like you on campus. The paramount thing that especially combat service members are thinking about when they're in combat zones or having to go into enemy fire some way, you know, in some place or other, is whether or not they trust the people around them. Whether the people around them are really the very best people based on merit, based on their shooting qualifications, based on their PR, fitness tests, and so on and so forth, not whether or not they share the same skin color as them or ancestry as them. I think that's a really important thing to think about. And so in some ways, the military academies and the military itself, it's much more important to treat everyone equally. And to advance people and to accept people into the military based on merit, not on arbitrary classifications like someone's skin color, their ancestry.
Move over.
A very short statement to start for fairness purposes. Go Noles.
I'll take it for the fairness purposes given the topic.
The question I have is this. Is there any implication for historic black colleges and those decisions, particularly, for example, of Florida A&M at Florida in our state?
Any thoughts on that?
Not a question I've thought about a lot. I mean, I thought about it some in preparation for the Harvard argument. My understanding is that HBCUs, I mean, they have a historical purpose and mission, but they don't actually use race in admissions as a factor. So if that's true, which I assume it is, then I'm not sure it'll have much implication, but you know, it's not like they are excluding people on the basis of race. If they were, that would be illegal under Title VI and if they're public under the Constitution.
I'd say one additional thing, and that is just based on my, and this is not deep research or anything like that, but the, from what I understand in my own sort of shallow bit of research is that beyond sort of race preferences and admissions, if there are race preferences in other areas, like Justice Sasso was suggesting, in campuses and student groups or whatever else, I don't see that on HBCU campuses or an HBCU administrative efforts. Quite frankly, I don't know of too many HBCUs that have DEI departments, certainly not as robust as institutions like University of Michigan, where I think some statistic was that there are more administrators working on DEI than there are history professors. So the DEI aspect also, to the extent that that's a problem or something you know, related to these cases, is not, as far as I can tell, a problem on HBCU campuses.
Interesting. Judge Beamer.
First off, as a Tennessee transplant here in Florida, Ms. Norris, your Go Vols touch my heart. Thank you very much. But my question is in a broader constitutional context, rather than just the Students for Fair Admissions case. But in light of the decision in the New York Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin, where the Supreme Court abandoned a tiered scrutiny analysis for the Second Amendment, do any of you see this as a signal that there could be a potential abandonment of that tiered scrutiny analysis for all constitutional rights? And if not, is there a real or theoretical rationale for analyzing different constitutional rights depending on the right at issue?
I guess I should try and answer that question. I mean, that's a great question. It's a very good question. Let me try and answer it directly. I don't see a hint that they're going to abandon strict scrutiny or the standards of review that you speak of. And I always tell my students that those standards, because they're not part of the text of the Constitution, right? They're not part of the text. They are there as much to provide guidance to lower court judges and to litigators and lawyers and, frankly, the public, to the extent the public actually takes the time to read some of these cases, as much as anything else. And that's important because, as we all know, the Supreme Court can't decide every case. But it's also, I think, a signal to those same individuals that we want certain cases coming out a certain way. We don't want your garden variety socioeconomic legislation being overruled by judges, activist, conservative, however you want to describe yourself, because that's not your job. So that's why the rational basis test is highly, highly deferential. We want those laws upheld, and it better be arbitrary or capricious, otherwise don't bother. And the flip side, of course, is strict scrutiny. So no, I don't see any hint, although you're obviously correct about Bruin, but there's no constitutional textual basis and probably no constitutional historical basis for these standards of review. They're there to help provide guides and frankly, to help lawyers do their jobs a little easier. That's my take.
Anything to add? Go over here.
Thank you, everyone, for being on the panel. We really appreciate it. Mr. Westhill, you mentioned that you anticipate future cases developing the issues from this lawsuit, from these lawsuits. And so I wanted to ask the entire panel about some of the responses that have resulted because of this lawsuit. Harvard, for example, eliminated their essay portion and has divided it into 5 essays, only 200 words long, one of which is specifically asking about racial diversity of the applicant. And the Common Application, which I think applies to most universities in the country, now has a specific question in essay form about racial or diversity of the racial diversity of the applicant. And so I was wondering, is this going to result in new lawsuits specifically because they've simply recreated the checkbox through a 200-word essay?
So I was invoked there. So let me just say a couple things. One, I do think more litigation is going to be necessary here to determine what the boundaries are, what the parameters of Harvard and UNC are. We're sort of just speculating here. I think we're raising good points to support that speculation, but just speculation. So we'll have to see what the courts think about that. One way in which I think that's going to happen, actually, is by information gathering. about what's going on campuses. You know, affirmative action has been sort of a black box in elite admissions offices for a long period of time. But now there's a bigger spotlight on them, and there's a bigger spotlight just with my organization. We've launched what we call the After Affirmative Action Network, where we're gathering we're sort of a clearinghouse, gathering information from people on the inside and sharing that with litigious people like Cam. To see what they think about what schools are doing and changing their admissions practices in a number of other respects. But there's already a case that sort of preceded the decisions that we got in June, which my organization was involved in at least supporting in terms of amicus brief at the cert stage, and it's still sort of buffering right now at the Supreme Court, but it's called basically the TJ case. There's a high school in Northern Virginia that changed its admissions program, not using race to select its students, but in such a way that they were able to rejigger their entering classes to have a lot less Asians and more of preferred races like Black and Hispanic students entering this elite high school. That's being challenged as sort of a follow-up, basically, although it preceded the decisions, a follow-up to these decisions. What exactly do we mean about eliminating race discrimination? Is that something that's improper, right? Not explicitly using race to select students, but basically doing it, having the intent to change or gerrymander the racial composition of classes. I think so. I think that is illegal. And I'm hopeful that the court will take up the TJ case.
Interesting. All right, we unfortunately probably only have time for one more question, but hopefully our panelists can stick around.
I should have given you that.
And take some. Go ahead.
Terrific. My question is for the entire panel. To what degree could schools achieve their diversity goals by eliminating legacy admissions?
Yeah, that was part of our position in Harvard, was that Harvard should have to eliminate legacy preferences before it can turn to race. I mean, a lot of what elite institutions like Harvard were doing, in effect, was using race to offset their subsidies for rich white people. And I mean legacy preferences, I mean donor preferences, no offense, the fake sports preferences that Ivy Leagues do. I mean, there's lots of ways that white students were in particular favored. I mean, race was a negative only for one group at Harvard, and that was the Asians. And so that was our position. I, as a personal matter, don't like legacy preferences. I come from a family whose parents and siblings didn't go to college. I think that's sort of I don't think it's a good policy. I think they should get rid of it. I know that there's an OCR complaint against, I believe, Harvard, one of the Ivy Leagues, about legacy preferences. So I think that's something they should look at. I'm not saying that they're necessarily illegal. And that wasn't our position. Our position was, if you're going to turn to race, you need to first eliminate the things that discriminate against Blacks and Hispanics often, and look at ways you can do that through race-neutral means.
Anything to add? All right. Well, I think we are out of time. Thank you all so much for your attention today. Please join me in giving our panelists a round of applause.